Film Spotting is presented by Spout.com. This week, Spout's wondering just how much Watchmen footage will be released before the movie. Keep an eye on all the coverage at blog.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Matty Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. This week on the show, Matty and I stand outside your window blaring Peter Gabriel on our boomboxes as we count down our top five movie soundtracks.
Plus, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music by Connor Oberst, and Matty's Movie Minute takes on, wait for it, Beverly Hills Chihuahua.
Takes on Beverly Hills Chihuahua or rehashes your latest dating disaster. Which one, Matty?
Either way.
Nice.
Either way, it's a winner.
I look forward to it. We'll also have a brief discussion of Blindness, the new film from the director of City of God and The Constant Gardener. But first, a review of Body of Lies, which, judging by the title, I can only assume is a direct-to-DVD starring Shannon Tweed.
Our world as we know it is a lot simpler to put to an end than you might think.
The day the car gets immobilized, start shooting, nobody gets traded, everybody dies.
Same as every day.
Got it.
Oops.
How the hell do you expect me to run an operation when you're running a side operation?
I'm just trying to back you up, buddy. It's a dangerous, dangerous world out there, you know?
It's not working.
This little war will go on with or without you.
Adam, I think it's pretty safe to say that outside of documentaries, we've been left pretty cold by films whose major concentrations have been on the war on terror.
True.
And specifically the ongoing conflict in Iraq. And the movie-going public seems to agree with us, as those films such as Lions for Lambs and Rendition, both out last fall, were pretty much box office bombs. Well, here comes Ridley Scott. Legendary, I think it's an appropriate adjective to use, director of blockbusters such as Gladiator, Black Hawk Down, Alien, Thelma and Louise, and of course, Blade Runner. Mr. Scott now brings us Body of Lies, teaming up Leonardo DiCaprio as a CIA operative entrenched in the Middle East, and Russell Crowe, a CIA director entrenched in suburbia, finding time to direct covert operations while playing soccer dad in rural suburban Virginia. Both of our characters employ a unique and differing purview on the war, or at least the way they go about fighting it.
Mm-hmm.
They're established very early on. And I suppose those viewpoints could be regarded as extensions of the divided feelings we hold here at home regarding the war. Are we supposed to trust one character more than the other? Or is this film really trying to say anything about the war? Is it, Adam? Is it an Iraq film at all? Or is this just an excuse for some great helicopter chases and popcorn rattling explosions?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, I do think the movie is trying to say something, and I actually think it goes about saying it very well. And by that, I mean, it doesn't get too preachy or get bogged down in speechifying. That's one thing I actually liked about it.
There's that opening about a minute where Russell Crowe we establish how he's ruthless.
That's
true. You can't trust anybody. How he's going to go about it. You're right. There's that. Once we abandon that,
mm-hmm.
no one stands on the mount and preaches at us.
No, it never tries too hard. It doesn't get bogged down in didacticism. I really did like that about the film. And unfortunately, to really answer your question, I'm going to have to throw it back on you, Matty. As you know, I knew going into this film that there was going to be a chance that I'd have to walk out with about 30 minutes left. I wasn't looking forward to it, but I knew it could happen. And sure enough, it happened. I had to leave. And this is a first in the history of Film Spotting. I'm sure I've missed a few minutes of a film before, a few minutes at the beginning or the end. I've never actually missed 25 to 30 minutes of it. And so I don't know whether or not it then falls into a pretty conventional thriller and gets, unfortunately, sidetracked maybe by some plot machinations. I have to admit that what I saw, though, for the first 100 minutes was one of the best thrillers I've seen in a long time, and certainly the best recent movie to deal directly with the fallout from 9/11 and the war in Iraq. I thought there maybe were a couple of unnecessary expository moments, and the inclusion of a love interest for DiCaprio was a diversion that we really didn't need in this film.
But
the film was better than that.
She is oh so beautiful, though.
Yeah, she really is. I mean, I enjoyed watching the actress on screen. She's very talented, and I enjoyed even their scenes together. I felt like it belonged in another film. However, I think the movie, as I said, is better than that. I think that it's smarter than that. And so I really enjoyed it. My question back to you then is, does the last 30 minutes live up to those first 100?
Yeah, it falls completely in line. And I'm with you. I was so worried because the opening of this film just felt so generic. I felt like I had been there before. There's a bomb going off in Manchester. We see these sort of rather menacing-looking terrorists sitting around a room. And then you have Russell Crowe giving this sort of overwritten speech. And then you've got Leo DiCaprio in this awful, awful beard. But once this film stops trying to say anything,
right,
I was sucked in.
Mm-hmm.
I really was. I mean, I reach into the film spotting cliche hat. I really was on the edge of my seat. I think it's right up there as one of the best action movies of the year. I put it up there with Iron Man, Tell No One, a great French film this year, a great thriller, and The Dark Knight. Mm-hmm. I think this one's right up there.
I do too. From what I saw.
It's an exercise in formula. It is a traditional spy film. It's sort of a Jean Le Carré, you know, that old world sort of formula, this sort of convoluted plot set here in our current global environment. I didn't necessarily buy any of the plot line at all. In fact, some of it is just absolutely preposterous.
Hmm.
But what Ridley Scott is so good at doing is pushing this film along, going, nope, go, 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 go. He doesn't let you sit down and think about what's actually happening. And I had a lot of fun with that.
Yeah, I did too. And you're right, he does keep it going. But the thing is, he does it without getting overly stylized or flashy. This isn't an MTV-style movie at all. And that's what I really respect about it. It's just a well-put-together thriller.
Well, he does those action sequences so well. You can't help but marvel at the way he brings you in with the camera and then brings you out. And here, literally, with these satellite photos this time that he can play with.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And that's one of the things I liked about the movie, too, is that it is a movie about technology in some ways, or it shows how technology is used today in espionage and in terrorist communications without actually making the movie about that.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't get bogged down in showing us the flashy devices and the technology that they're using, even though it's there, it's very prevalent. What I mean is, think about a movie like Tony Scott's Enemy of the State, which tries to match that and show, oh, look at how people can tap into your phones and all that stuff. It tries to really show how cool all this equipment is. The movie just takes it as a matter of fact. It's just practical equipment. It's the nature of the game. I really like that. And it also does, we touched on this a little bit, it deals with the U.S.'s role in the world and its effect on terrorism and anti-U.S. sentiments around the world in a very direct way without making speeches, without getting preachy.
Right.
As I said, Scott kind of has his cake and eat it too here, I think, with the film, and that he's made an effective thriller that's also really smart without getting conventional or without getting, as I said, too heavy-handed and didactic. So I really think he pulls it off here. Again, I look forward. I didn't want to hear from you how the last 30 minutes go because I was so into the movie. I really want to see how they unfold, especially because at the moment I walked out, that's when I'm guessing it's really hitting the fan.
Look, the film is a lot of fun. I don't think it says anything, but you're absolutely right. It's not trying to say much. It's just saying, here we go. It just gets you on board.
But it's not dumb about the things it is saying.
No, it's not dumb at all. And once you get beyond the fact that Russell Crowe is wearing this absolutely needless raging bull body.
Yes.
And of course, he's got the full makeup on. And I just want to shake my head. And that's why you need to see Tropic Thunder, because Robert Downey Jr. is doing a dead-on Russell Crowe. The more I think about it, it's not Sean Penn who he's spoofing there. It is Russell Crowe.
Yeah, in a lot of ways. Though, of course, you know they had to set up that very clear dichotomy. Did it need to be that clear? But you've got the guy on the ground and the guy back at home in suburbia, as you said, calling all the shots. And he's, you know, he's no longer in shape, right? He can't take DiCaprio anymore. He can just make the rules and give out orders.
And he can make the rules so much easier because he doesn't actually know what it's like on the ground.
Right.
I mean, he is sort of this Cheney Rumsfeldian character if you want to go that far.
Right.
My other question is, why have DiCaprio try a southern accent?
I don't know.
Why?
I don't know.
He doesn't need to run it out there. Once you get beyond that artifice, the movie works fine, but it took me longer to get on board because I'm just thinking, I understand these actors are having a lot of fun with this,
right,
but you don't need to go that far.
No.
At one point, pull it back. You know, about 3 weeks in, you know, into rehearsal or reading the script, someone can say, hey, Leo, you know what? That was a lot of fun, the first read-throughs with the southern accent.
Yeah.
I don't think we need to do that anymore.
I know, and I said to you that when I first saw the trailer, I thought, what the hell is DiCaprio doing? And then I said, but wait, I thought that about The Departed, and I loved him in The Departed. So I give Leo the benefit of the doubt, but I will say here that I'm completely with you on the performances. They're still fun to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Leo DiCaprio and Russell Crowe together and apart just talking on the phone are still fun to watch.
I think DiCaprio's better.
He is better here. There's no doubt about it. But even being fun, this is the first time with those two guys. And we're going to talk about actor pairings a little bit later in listener feedback. We discussed it a few weeks ago here on the show. This is the first time I watched these great actors that I love, and I really felt like they were both acting. Everything was a little too mannered. Not only DiCaprio's accent, but also the mode of talking that Crow has in the movie and his glasses and the cell phone earpiece he wears throughout. It was just a little too calculated for both of the guys throughout. Again, I still think they're fun to watch, but they could have been better, I think.
Well, the whole movie is just fun. Just don't go in thinking, you know, thinking about this film too much. And that's actually, I know it sounds like a backhanded compliment, but it's not.
No.
It really is just an exciting thriller that I was longing for all summer and I really didn't get. And we have to give a shout out, if we're talking about great performances, to Mark Strong as the head of the Jordanian intelligence.
I'm sure we're going to be one of a million saying this.
Right.
But Mark Strong is brilliant.
He's brilliant here. And he's playing this sort of cool, calculated, again, sort of circa 1985 instead of a Russian spy.
Yeah.
You know, now he's a Jordanian
That's
guy.
That's it. He's not the KGB heavy anymore.
Right.
He's the head of Jordanian intelligence. His name's Hani Pasha. And you're right. I loved him here in this film. And it's actually, part of it is a function of the movie. DiCaprio's character reveres Hani Pasha so that every time we see them together, we kind of revere him a little bit too. But that said, his performance is just so good that every time DiCaprio was going to go talk to him, I found myself getting excited that we were going to get to go spend more time with him. I mean, I really realized, I'm like, oh, yay, he gets to go talk to Hani Pasha. I just really like watching him so much. He's regal, and he's someone you instantly respect, while at the same time, you kind of know that he would sell you out in a heartbeat if he had to. He also is a dead-on ringer, maybe, for a young, less Arabic-looking
Andy Garcia.
Yeah. It finally hit me halfway through the movie. I'm like, this is Andy Garcia, and he's good. Andy Garcia is a pretty good actor, and they have that same kind of shark-like behavior from Ocean's 11, but he's just way more elegant and graceful and so suave. He really is a big reason why you should go check out this movie.
Yeah, it is so much fun. Look, you're not going to leave the theater asking, who do you trust in a time of war? But you are going to leave the theater thinking, wow, I can trust Ridley Scott with this kind of action material. And my faith is a little bit restored.
Yeah, no, that's very well said. I might give him a little more credit with the intelligence of the script and what it's saying, but I agree with you, that's dead on. You will have your faith restored by Ridley Scott, even though this is the worst title for a movie ever.
Wow.
This is a movie, I'm sorry, it deserves, I know it's just a thriller, Maddie, it deserves a much better title than Body of Lies. I really can't get over it, but it is out now in theaters everywhere. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail by calling 206-203-2463, and you must use a southern accent whether you have one or not.
Okay, time for a quick break. When we come back, Massacre Theater, and it's the blind, Adam, leading the naked, Maddie, our review of the new thriller, Blindness. Stay with us.
A short delay, the parrot blues, little voices mimic you. It's not so hard to make that sound. So watch your back, the Ides of March. Cut your hair like Joan of Arc. Disguise your will, they'll find you out. And when they do, look out. There's money lenders inside the temple. That circus tiger's gonna break your heart. Something so wild turned into paper. If I loved you, well, that's my fault.
Jesus, Lily, there's been 3 rapes and 2 murders in this park in 1 year.
I didn't do it.
We're gonna freeze to death.
If you leave, you won't have that problem, will you? What's the story on that dog?
What?
What's the story on that dog?
That's a dog that saved Charleston from the 1938 flood.
Well, fuck him.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. Time now for everybody's favorite part of the show, Massacre Theater, wherein Adam and I perform a scene from a beloved screenplay, and you, our beloved listeners, get a chance at winning the beloved DVD of your choice. It does not have to be Oprah Winfrey's Beloved.
No.
Now, last week we massacred the scene you just heard between Lindsay Krause and Paul Newman from Slapshot, a tie-in, of course, with our tribute to the late, great actor. And I do love that film. We're putting on the foil here at Film Spotting this week.
It's a great movie. I was a little disappointed with the number of entries, Maddie.
I was too, but it's so interesting. Again, every week, which movies people respond to. And
yeah,
we received names this week that we have never seen before. And I have to say, Canada and the upper Midwest was represented really well.
Definitely well represented, with hockey season just around the corner. And of course, Lindsay Krause, David Mamet's first wife, also in The Verdict, with Paul Newman. And I also want to share one quick fact, Maddie, from Patrick Kelly in Altoona, Pennsylvania. With his entry, he included this nugget. Much of Slapshot was filmed 40 miles away from here in Johnstown, PA, and according to a Pittsburgh Post-Gazette article, the dog statue in that scene actually does exist, but his Johnstown Flood hero status is pure urban legend. So,
well, actually, the team was based on the Johnstown Jets. And, yeah, of course, the Hansen brothers were real people. The Carlson brothers are from northern Minnesota.
Very good.
All right, well, why don't you reach into that film spotting hat and pull out this week's winner.
And the winner is Josh Spiegel in Glendale, Arizona.
Glendale. All right, I'm going to put it up by Tempe, Arizona.
Why not? Congratulations, Josh. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we will set you up with the DVD of your choice.
It's a scene, man. Memorize it.
What?
Look, man, an undercover cop's got to be Marlon Brando, right? To do this job, you got to be a great actor. You got to be naturalistic. You got to be naturalistic as hell.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater. And Maddie, I think we will go ahead and say it this time. It does tie in with our top five theme this week, top five movie soundtracks.
Yeah, I think the baby boomers in our audience might be able to relate to this
one. You just gave it away without even doing a line.
Did I?
Oh, did I? Okay, you're being tricky here. Let's go ahead and do it. You start it off. I'm going to give you the action. And action.
They're in transition from a monogamous relationship and they need more space, or they're tired of space and they just can't commit, or they want to commit but they're afraid to get close. Then they want to get close and then you don't want to get near them.
It can't be that bad.
You don't know. I'm going easy. I've been out there dating for the last 20 years. I've gotten where I can tell in the first 15 seconds if there's a chance in the world.
Well, at least you're giving it a fair shot.
Yeah, that's easy for you to say. Married to blank, the perfect man. I don't know. Sometimes I think I don't even want a man anymore. Here I sit on my ticking biological clock, and the only thing I've known in my entire life is that I want to have a child.
So, what do you do?
I'm going to have a baby.
What?
And scene.
Maddie, you are giving up on men. You told me that just last week. If you know what film we just massacred, send us an email along with the movie's title, your name, and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. You have until Wednesday, October 15th.
Yes, you do. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries. Hopefully, we'll have more than we did for Slapshot and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, please visit us at www.filmspotting.net.
All right, Maddie, we're going to get to our discussion of the movie Blindness here in a moment, but first, you somehow managed to get a woman to go see Beverly Hills Chihuahua.
Maddie's Movie Minute. He takes us to the show for 60 seconds or so and gets right to the point of what we need to know.
And now,
here's Maddie.
Okay, Adam. So, I was set up this past week. I don't usually like going to movies on first dates because it eats up 2 hours of your time and prevents you, as you know, from getting to know each other.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, everything started off okay. Absolutely beautiful woman, actually out of my league, as most women are. We had a great sort of Bob Newhart in Chicago day. We had fantastic soul food, a jazz brunch, Bloody Marys at the top of the Hancock.
Will you take me out next week, Matt?
Yeah, great walk along Michigan Avenue, chocolate at Ghirardelli's. Only one problem. She didn't say anything.
Yeah.
Seriously. Not a word. And people actually may be surprised when I'm not babbling into this microphone once a week. I'm really not that verbose. I think you can attest to that.
Yeah, that's true.
But if I didn't say anything during this date, it was crickets. I'm serious. Tumbleweeds rolling in front of us. And don't get me wrong. I mean, one of the great barometers for how comfortable you are with a person is when you can sit in complete silence with them. Right? Don't you agree? You and your wife can sit right in the parlor.
Sure.
Not speak a word for hours on end.
It's not quite that bad.
But not on a first date.
No.
So, my God, I was struggling to vamp. Basically going hoarse, dipping into my stand-up routines from the late 90s. I'm serious. I was dragging out Janet Reno jokes. And I'm trying to get to know her, asking her questions, you know, like I'm in the CIA. And seriously, she would make a wonderful spy because she wasn't giving anything up. All I know is that I'm pretty sure that she lives in the greater Chicago area. So we go to the movie. I'm relieved. I'm actually relieved to be sitting watching Disney's Beverly Hills Chihuahua. Best thing I can say about the film is that the premise was better than the execution. It's not offensively bad, it's just not that funny, and worst of all, it didn't give us anything to talk about. So once the movie let out, I'm opening the door to the cab at her place, getting ready to, you know, sort of roll out the, well, thanks, and share that, you know, we both know what happened here kind of uncomfortable look.
Uh-huh.
She says, So were you serious about taking me to the Second City show sometime next week? I was floored. Seriously, the longest sentence she had said all night.
Maddie's Movie Minute. Maddie's Movie Minute. Quick reviews to help you choose it. Maddie's Movie Minute.
I love that segment, Maddie, because it does actually remind me how happy I am to be married. But we gave our listeners a choice last week. We said there's two new movies out, Blindness, Fernando Morales, the director, or the new film Appaloosa, the Western with Viggo Mortensen and Ed Harris. Ed Harris also directed it. We gave them a vote at filmspotting.net to decide which one we would review, and Blindness won it 60% to 40%. And I will just mention real quick what I said a few weeks ago when I returned from Toronto. I saw Appaloosa there, and it was a huge disappointment for me. I love Ed Harris as an actor, but I didn't love his direction on Pollock, and I was even less enthused about it here. Appaloosa has bad writing, bad structure, bad blocking in a lot of cases, and there are a lot of good actors wasted, unfortunately. So I will be really curious to hear what your reaction to it is at some point, Maddie. With Blindness, I saw it at 10:35 last night. I was so alert for this screening that I didn't even notice that we don't get any character names. If you look at IMDb, you just see listings such as Doctor, Doctor's Wife, that's Mark Ruffalo and Julianne Moore, Bartender / King of Ward 3, that's the great Gael Garcia Bernal. And of course, typically that's a sign that you're dealing with some kind of allegory. These characters and their predicament represent something larger. But I have to put out a warning here. This movie is not for anyone who likes their movie-going experiences to be pleasant. Blindness is 120 minutes of deplorable human behavior under extreme and extremely rancid conditions. So Maddie, please, enlighten me. What is the allegory here, and was the payoff worth waiting through 2 hours of awfulness?
No.
No?
No. It is a film that strives to say so much, but I think ends up saying so little. And I actually enjoyed it most when it was focusing in on that filth, but unfortunately it's a much larger film than that. You know, the director and the screenwriter, Don McKellar, here actually go about it the right way, because I think this is material probably left best suited to be covered by a made-for-TV miniseries, preferably on cable.
Yeah.
But if you're going to use 2 hours to deal with an epidemic of sudden blindness affecting the whole of humanity, which is happens here, the only way to do it is to focus on the struggles of a small group of people. And I give them credit. This film isn't about what caused the disease, who caused the disease.
No.
It focuses on this group of 6 or 7 people that are confined to this abandoned hospital. And I think that's where this film could have lived and really succeeded, within those walls, playing out as sort of a modern-day Lord of the Flies meets No Exit. But unfortunately, rather than really casting a penetrating eye on this sort of that raw, disgusting, violent breakdown of humanity within those walls, the focus gets softened and undermined by conventional Hollywood formula, puns absolutely intended. And on the one hand, you've got this film, it's longing to operate as some kind of gritty expose, almost like an inmate sort of battling against the confines of a straitjacket. On the other, it's more than happy to roll out Hollywood convention after Hollywood convention. This film shows us the filth collecting in the hallways. Yes, the depravity these people have to live through. But ultimately, the film pulls its punches. After 3 weeks of living in this hellhole of a hospital, this place should have been a hellhole. No one should have been able to function in there. But somehow, they're just clean enough for the Hollywood censors. And if that's not enough, they have to roll out Danny Glover as this
the voice of wisdom
to give this narration about what's happening outside the hospital.
It was awful.
It felt so flat, completely unnecessary. And it's those conventional results. I felt like this was a little movie, a little gritty movie, trapped in sort of big Hollywood ideas, and it ends up not saying much.
What's the matter?
I can't see.
What?
I think I was infected by that patient I saw yesterday.
Over 90% of the population has been infected with an epidemic of blindness. The white sickness is highly contagious. There are no visible signs of trauma or symptoms. There is no cure.
Yeah, I agree with you, though. I actually would disagree on the part about you wanting maybe more degradation and filth. For me, it was actually a little bit too much.
Really?
And I'll admit that I have a really conflicted reaction to this film because I didn't enjoy more than 15 or 20 minutes of it, and I don't feel comfortable recommending it to anyone. But my three main problems with it are all things I actually liked about other recent movies. It's unrelentingly bleak and ugly. It's filled with moments that made me look away from the screen, but that same bleakness and that hopelessness is what I really liked about the movie 28 Weeks Later, for example, and also the movie Hunger that I recently saw in Toronto, and it's going to play here in Chicago at the film festival. I will say, though, that one difference between this and 28 Weeks Later is that it's actually possible that that movie, with flesh-eating zombies on the rampage, may actually be more subtle in its savagery than Blindness. That's my reaction anyway. I also had a hard time dealing with how insular it was. You touched on the Danny Glover scene, which is terrible, that tries to give us some sense outside those walls confining them. But you had absolutely no sense of what was going on other than that sequence outside the quarantine building, not in the city, the country, the world. And well, I understand that's the point.
You wouldn't need that if you could completely shift your focus onto what's going on. Make it an allegory. Make it, you know, do something like Lost is trying to do on television. Mm-hmm. Make it about, or think back to that film, The Mist, last year. Again, trying to do the same thing. People trapped as humanity sort of devolves in front of our eyes.
Yeah, we're seeing this a lot recently.
Yeah.
You're right. The Mist actually works there too very well. But that same thing I'm complaining about, I actually liked in the movie Sunshine, the Danny Boyle film, where we're trapped with the crew members up in space on their mission the whole time. We mm-hmm. don't get to see what's going on down on Earth. And I also thought that Morales went overboard with the style. He's a very stylish director, and he's trying so hard to put us through the same experience.
That milky white.
Yeah,
oh.
Yeah, we're seeing the white blindness that the characters are going through and what they're seeing, but it immediately reminded me of The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, which was one of my favorite movies of last year. So the bottom line is I'm actually really confused on my take with this film. But again, I go back to the fact that you add all those things up, and I just had such a unpleasant time sitting through it, and I felt like it actually got bogged down too much. I felt like Morales actually relished too much showing us the shots of the naked woman laying on the cot, and he wanted to show us that so badly and shock us in a way and disgust us that I didn't get into the story at all.
I think he wanted to show us even more but was held back.
Maybe.
I really do, and you're absolutely right. If you're gonna go there, go there. Don't tiptoe around it or pull it back. It's not enough for you to go halfway with those scenes. You either have to fully embrace the concept or not. And the best moments for me were actually there in the hospital, the Marat Saad sort of inmates running the asylum mm-hmm. angle. I think Gael Garcia Bernal, he's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
He is brilliant as this kid who anoints himself monarch of the rival ward. And Maury Chaykin, the great character actor, plays his Smee as this sort of joyously
yeah.
ruthful. And I love the interaction between those wards. And then, this is a small spoiler, but not really, between Julianne Moore, who can see while she's in the hospital.
Yeah.
And she's basically kind of becoming the nurse, the mother, or there's that
to
struggle
everyone.
Whether she's going to become the nurse and the mother to that ward. And again, if you could highlight on those struggles, really concentrate on those people really bumping up against each other. That's a film. We didn't need everything else that surrounded this thing.
No, we probably didn't. What I do know, though, as I said, I'm very confused on my reaction to this movie, is that I think the first 15 to 20 minutes here is really strong, I think. And I actually encourage anyone who praised the opening of The Happening, a very similar film in a lot of ways, to go back and check out this film, because I think Morales does it a lot better in terms of setting up the tension here and actually having some decent performances. Of course, the big difference between the two films, a lot less unintentional comedy here.
Oh, this film needed some comedy.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just so darn earnest during
yeah.
the whole thing.
No, that's actually a really good point. That may be, again, too, when I think about the unrelenting way it was so bleak, there was no humor here at all. But, you know, Morales, he really is good at moving and using the camera. And especially during that first 15 to 20 minutes, as I said, you see it in the opening of The Constant Gardener, which I think the first half of that film is fantastic. And of course, I did like City of God, as most people I know did as well. But this film, for me, I wanted to be provoked by it, and actually I just really wanted to get out of the theater, not think about what the movie was trying to say.
Oh, it wanted to say so much and ended up saying so very, very little.
Well, Blindness is out now in theaters everywhere. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us at feedback@filmspotting.net.
All right, time for a quick break. Up next, come on, guys, show the ladies a little love. We are more than happy to oblige here at Film Spotting. Listener feedback is next. Stay with us.
Saw an eagle on pole. I think it was an eagle. Watched its shadow fly across the cement. I woke up in the snow. All the trees were crowds of people. No coat, no shoes, no idea where they went. I followed the fence line thin, back where the yard begins. My woman, she stood crying like a man. So where have you been? Where have you been? I thought you said that all of that was done.
Hello, Adam and Maddie. It is Paul Moore from Spout.com with the week in news from Spout Blog, which you can read at blog.spout.com. This week, Ridley Scott and Leonardo DiCaprio announced that they will be making Brave New World, the book, into a movie. Also, Kevin and Kelly and Karina Longworth react to watching 26 minutes from The Watchmen. They describe what they saw and what they think about it. In case you haven't noticed, Wall Street is in a bit of trouble. And Wall Street, the movie, has come up in conversation. The screenwriter wrote an article about all the young executives who come up to him saying how inspiring his villain, Gordon Gekko, played by Michael Douglas, how inspiring he's been to their careers. We write about how maybe it's not the bad things that Gordon Gekko does that people want to do, but it's the bad things that he does with so much passion. And as usual, we have lists for the week. Several lists, actually, one of which is called 10 Underrated Bill Murray Movies. Check it all out on blog.spout.com.
Thought the kettle was a train. Thought that Monday was a door frame.
Hey, this is John in Chattanooga. I've got a message for Bill, the director of Religulous. Bill, stop being logiculous if you're worried about the end of the world. All those nuclear and biological weapons are being made in laboratories, not churches. Adam and Maddie, love the show. Keep it up.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Maddie Robinson. I'm Adam Kempinar, and our lone voicemailer this week, Maddie, John in Chattanooga, who wants to tell Bill Maher that weapons aren't being made in churches. This is the same John who wrote, though. I have to point this out because John and I corresponded about the movie Religulous, the film we discussed last week, Bill Maher's new documentary, if you want to call it that. This is the same John who wrote that he was pleasantly surprised by the movie when he finally checked it out. Maher is incredibly witty and funny, and he will say that he was pretty much in agreement with him all the way through. So there you go.
Well,
you may be opposing it, but check it out anyway.
Well, I'm very glad that John actually saw the movie,
right?
Because unfortunately, a lot of people took this opportunity to sort of write in with their beliefs or their non-beliefs. They sort of took this opportunity to tell us where they stand on the issue. We're not really that interested in it if you haven't seen the film.
Exactly.
This is not a forum for that.
No, it really isn't. And only one person that we know of so far anyway has actually said maybe they're unsubscribing because of it. I have to say, I'm a little surprised that our favorable review of Religulous only prompted one person to say they might unsubscribe again that we know of who actually took the time to write in. But anytime you're talking about religion, we touch on this a little bit, you're going to get people to come out and get angry about it. People want to defend their faith. I absolutely understand that. But that is something Maher is out there challenging in Religulous. We said to check it out. Some people are going to disagree, obviously. Our poll question last week on the show, let's get to our results here, Maddie. We asked you what your favorite Paul Newman performance is. Of course, a tie-in with our tribute to Paul Newman last week where we counted down our top five favorite Newman performances. And you know, not a big surprise here probably with the results. Here were the options. Butch Cassidy, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, Cool Hand Luke, The Hustler, Slapshot, The Sting, The Verdict, or other. And just the fact that you have to include all those in the poll question tells you something about that great career. How did it come out, Maddie?
Well, 35% of our Film Spotting audience agrees with us. Cool Hand Luke, number one. Butch Cassidy, 24% in second place. The Hustler, 11%, tying with The Sting, also at 11%, followed by Other. Now, I do have to mention another Film Spotting intern was fired this week because, unbeknownst to me, well, I'm sure I did have to sign off on this.
You did.
HUD was not included
it's
among
in
the
there
choices.
With other.
Right,
obviously.
Exactly. Well, I think it could stand alone. The Verdict at 6%, Slapshot at 4%, and Cat on a Hot Tin Roof coming in at 4%.
Only 4% for our number five choice, but again, so many great ones to choose from there. We appreciate everyone who voted in last week's poll. And this week's question, we want to know what you think about Ridley Scott, of course, the director of Body of Lies, the film we reviewed in the last segment. And you touched on it last week. You had a great line, Maddie, where you said, you know, we were previewing the next show, and you said, yeah, it's about time we're underwhelmed by a Ridley Scott movie. Unfortunately, he's been a little underwhelming lately. We want to know what you think of him as a director, and we're taking this poll question almost verbatim from the great film spotting message board. So, rate Ridley Scott as a director.
He's great. I'll watch anything he does. He certainly makes my list, but I can think of many who are better. He's unpredictable, but I give him the benefit of the doubt. He's too hit and miss for me to trust him, or he's always been overrated.
This is a tough one for me, Maddie. Where do you put Ridley Scott in this question?
You know, he's unpredictable, but I give him the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, that's where I'd go, though I could actually see bumping him up too. He certainly makes my list, but I can think of many who are better. I don't put him in the top 10 or 15 or maybe 20 all time of directors, but he is one of those directors who I give the benefit of the doubt to. If there's a new movie coming out, I still want to go see it, despite some of the ones that are lackluster. There's just too many good films on his resume. And actually, I want to mention that last year, when we reviewed American Gangster, our poll question was to rate Ridley Scott's best film, excluding Alien and Blade Runner, and Gladiator came in at 43%. But there were all sorts of great choices on that list. He really has made some great films.
Ladies and gentlemen, if I say I'm an oil man, you will agree. I've traveled across half our state to be here and to see about this land. I'm a family man. This is my son and my partner, H.W. Plainview.
You boys are a regular family business.
You boys are a little late.
A scene there, of course, from last year's There Will Be Blood. Daniel Day-Lewis, last year's Best Actor winner at the Oscars. And that ties in with our top five from a few weeks ago, our actor pairings. We were inspired by Robert De Niro and Al Pacino being in the terrible movie Righteous Kill together. We came up with the five choices, the five pairings we would most like to see. Our listeners also weighed in, like John Heberle in Bay Village, Ohio, who has a lot of love for Daniel Day-Lewis.
Are you ready for this? I'm about to tell you about the best film of the year. Daniel Day-Lewis works in a factory in Flint, Michigan. He is divorced, yet still in love with his ex-wife. Of course he is. He struggles to pay the child support for his two daughters, 17 and 12. I'm so glad John provided the ages.
That.
When the factory closes down due to outsourcing, he struggles to make ends meet. Obviously, we're going to set this in like 1988 Flint, because I don't know if there's a lot there. Then his brother, the black sheep of the family, played by the Viggo Mortensen, comes to town with a business proposition. They're going to rob the local bank. All this, of course, is patent pending.
Yeah, what do you think about that one, Maddie? I think the idea, John, unfortunately, is maybe a little bit stale, but the fact is, any movie with Daniel Day-Lewis and Viggo Mortensen, I would go see it.
Oh, man. They'd have to give out two Oscars that year.
Yeah, they would. So very nicely done there, John. We got this one as well from Carter Nixon in New Zealand, who says, what are the chances you can stop film spotting and move straight into production on that Javier Bardem, Paul Rudd film immediately? I love the show and all, but I am prepared to go without it for a while to see that movie get made. Enlighten our listeners who may have missed that show or may not remember, what was the Bardem, Paul Rudd collaboration you came up with for your top five?
Well, that was a buddy movie film I was pitching. Basically, these two had a hit sitcom in the early 80s, and it was sort of like a buddy cop, foreign cop sort of famous, you know, tying in with The Perfect Strange a little bit, and Bardem played the Balky character, and Paul Rudd was the sarcastic tough guy. And of course, Javier Bardem, the Balky character, goes on to become one of the greatest actors of all time, winning Oscar after Oscar, and Paul Rudd basically finds his career in the tank. And then
it's a bosom buddies thing.
It's a bosom buddies thing, exactly. Yeah, oh,
Scolari
bosom
buddies
Hanks.
Meets
very
perfect
nice.
Strangers.
Exactly. It sort of examines, you know, that what celebrity in the late 20th century. But yeah, actually, people will be happy to know we are going to work on this.
We are.
Yeah, exactly. So we're
great. I'm glad to know that.
Not you.
Oh, great. I can't even be a grip on it, Maddie.
No.
Okay.
No, you can maybe watch the catering table. You could always join the Teamsters.
I could.
All right.
Maybe
well, Renee from Parts Unknown. Come on, Renee. Where are you from?
Where are you from? We need to know.
Come on, guys. Show the ladies a little love. I seem to recall you both saying that it is a shame that it is so difficult to find inspiring female-female pairings in film. Really now, I think that there are quite a few actresses who deserve more attention than just half of a love story. I offered that up. Clearly, my emailing efforts need to be spent injecting a little estrogen into the mix rather than defending your good judgment. Hear, hear. My pitch for five female duos.
Number five, and I like this one a lot. Julie Delpy and Amy Adams lead the cast of a lush period drama set in Versailles. Delpy plays an established and powerful duchess. Adams has only recently married into the French nobility. Delpy offers to help Adams establish herself in court with a not-so-secret motive of taking Adams as her lover.
I like it. I do, too.
Number four, Maggie Smith plays the picture of evil as the manipulative, scheming mother of Frank. Frank and his new wife, played by Maggie Gyllenhaal, are forced to return to Frank's home when Smith's erratic and hostile behavior flies out of control. I want to see both of those films.
Someone's going to end up dead in this Maggie Smith one.
Exactly.
I guarantee it. All right, well, number three, she offers up Martina Geddick and Franca Potente star as two German filmmakers who have to come to the wilds of Appalachia to shoot a documentary on Pentecostal snake handlers.
Nice.
Now, tensions rise as the younger, more idealistic of the two, played by Potente, becomes more and more mesmerized with the people who she's ostensibly researching. Then at number two, theater nerds meet sci-fi nerds. Caitlin Olson and Kristen Schaal both give breakthrough film performances in a screwball comedy. Schaal leads a ragtag community theater group, which is about to lose its funding. Olson is the leader of reigning sci-fi battle troupe and often appears dressed as a Klingon.
Nice.
I cannot wait for that. And at number one, Tracy Toms, Rosie Perez, car chases, explosions, snappy dialogue, and lots of kicking ass. Thanks for the great podcast, guys. Of course, a lot of people would recognize Tracy Toms, of course, from Death Proof, a great actress.
Yeah, she really is good. And Rosie Perez, of course, as well. That's an interesting pairing there. Some great picks there. Kristen Schaal is an actress who, of course, is on The Daily Show recently, makes some appearances
Flight of
there.
The Conchords. She really kind of grates on me, this character that she runs out constantly. And Caitlin Olson is on one of my favorite shows, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Martina Geddick is another name, though, that we're both not familiar with. With Franca Potente, of course, from The Bourne Identity there, and Run, Lola, Run. So some good names, and we appreciate Renee calling us out on the fact that we didn't have many women on that list. This always seems to happen. I will say in my defense, though, I really didn't do anything about it. I called you the day we were going to record, and I said, Maddie, how many women do you have on your list? Because I'm feeling really bad about only having two. And you're like, one? And I said, okay, well, then I'm going to look like the hero because I got two on my list. I thought I at least made an effort there. We do appreciate, again, Renee calling us out there.
This thing hurts. Go tell Clint and Wendell we're coming in.
Clint, Wendell, time to eat!
I could have done that.
A clip there from the Spike Lee film Crooklyn. Of course, recently on the show, we did share our top five Spike Lee scenes, tying in with our discussion of his recent film, Miracle at St. Anna. And I wish we had more time. We could get into the great batch of Spike Lee scenes here that our listeners sent in. But let's go ahead and get to Eileen Hunter in Long Beach, California.
I know that it isn't his most important film, but my favorite Spike Lee film, the one that moved me the most and still haunts me when I think about it now, is Crooklyn. It is so effective as an impressionistic mood piece that by the time the film moves into the funeral sequence, set perfectly to Ooh Child, she's absolutely right about that, I am overwhelmed by my grief for these people I don't know and nostalgic for someone else's childhood.
Well said.
I don't know how Lee managed that, but I consider it to be a major, major achievement. And it speaks to a point that I want to touch on. A lot of people find Lee confrontational. A lot of people find Lee's work not speaking to their way of life. In fact, exactly the opposite, speaking against it oftentimes. I disagree on that wholeheartedly, and I think Crooklyn is a great example of that.
Yeah, it really is a good kind of family movie. I mean, that's what it's about, and you do get nostalgic for this life you never had in many ways. I think Eileen put it very well. I was glad to see Crooklyn make your top five. You had a scene there, I believe, is your number five. Certainly a movie I considered as well. We appreciate, as always, the great feedback. If you want to send us a comment at any time, do so at feedback@filmspotting.net.
All right, time for one last quick break. When we come back, the K-Billy Super Sounds of the 70s marathon continues with our top five movie soundtracks. Keep on trucking.
Gone, gone from New York City. Where you gonna go with a head that empty? Gone, gone from New York City. Where you gonna go with a heart that gone? Down, down to Mexico City. Got myself a lady, she know how to treat me. Down, down to Mexico City. Got myself a lady to lay me down. When I go, but I'll see you down the road. Meet me at the station way down low, way down low. Gone, gone from New York City. Where you gonna go with a head that empty? Gone, gone from New York City. Where you gonna go with a heart that gone? Where you gonna go with a heart that gone?
Time now to take a look at what is new on DVD. Maddie, coming out this Tuesday, I feel like we just talked about this movie not too long ago coming out. Maybe I'm getting mixed up somehow, but 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days is out now. Yeah. This was a big favorite from the end of last year and the beginning of this year.
Well, I've been planning my 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days party for a long time.
Sure.
We're going to bring over about 30 people. It's going to be just a rip-roaring good time.
It's so bleak and so depressing in a lot of ways, but it is a very good film.
Oh,
Christian Mungiu, the Romanian
well done.
Director. Very good film. A film that is not as good as 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
You gave this thing a pass.
I gave it a pass, and I actually recommended it, and I still probably recommend it, even though I will freely admit, totally flawed. I discussed those flaws during the review, and actually, I realize now, totally forgettable. So forgettable. Nevertheless, you can check it out now on DVD as well as Mongol. This is a movie you reviewed here on the show, Maddie.
Yeah, it's a really solid epic about a young Genghis Khan. I think it's the first of a trilogy. It's pretty by the book, but there are some great, great battle scenes.
I look forward to seeing it. And War Inc. is out. This is the John Cusack movie. It was going to be a satire, of course, of war, as
right.
It says there in the title. Unfortunately, just got panned by the critics who actually took the time to see it. We did not. It's out now on DVD. I can't say I'm in a hurry to see it, as much as we like John Cusack.
We love John Cusack, but again, I think no one is going to see war films, especially films about Iraq, and they tried to sneak this one out and
maybe they
made
did.
About $5.
The big movie, though, I think maybe the biggest release here that I'm most interested in seeing, this is a Criterion Collection edition of Killing of a Chinese Bookie, the John Cassavetes film. I've been looking forward to finally seeing this movie for a long time. Now you've got a restored high-definition digital transfer of the original 135-minute edit of the movie. You've got video interviews with the star Ben Gazzara, one of the Cassavetes regulars, of course, and all sorts of other extra features there. So I really do recommend checking it out. Even if it's not a good film, I'm guessing it is, I do really want to check out the Criterion edition of Killing of a Chinese Bookie.
All right, well, it's time now for donations, and Adam and I want to thank everyone who surfed their way over to filmspotting.net and threw some of their hard-earned dollars our way in the last week in support of the show. As always, we are truly humbled by each and every single donation that we receive. It goes such a long way in keeping us doing what we're doing. So thank you, thank you, thank you to Gold Club donor Robin from Seattle, Washington. Of course, we do have a lot of listeners out there.
We do, and we're going to get to Seattle here in a minute with another bit of news here, but Robin is a multiple Gold Club donor. I know there's a few others out there who have really been supporting the show over the years, and we may not always remember your name, but Robin has been a longtime emailer and supporter of the show through donations. We really do appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. And thanks to also our Silver Club donor, Anne Marie, in Pasadena, California. I want to retire to Pasadena,
really?
California. Oh, I love it.
Isn't
the
it near
City
Chino?
Of Roses. No,
no,
it's not anywhere near Chino.
Oh.
I don't know what you're thinking about. We also want to thank Jonathan in Boulder, Colorado. Jonathan is a regular
yes,
donor.
And like a monthly donor.
Exactly.
Someday he might win After Hours.
I hope so. I hope so. And thanks as well to all of our $2 monthly donors. And remember that for every $10 you donate, your name gets entered into that film spotting hat, and at the end of the month, we pick a name, and you get to pick a film for us to review on an upcoming edition of Film Spotting After Hours, and also you're entered probably to win some film spotting
swag. A mug
or
a shirt, yep.
And if you'd like to donate, go to filmspotting.net and click on the donation tab. It's right there. It's right there at the top of the page.
Yes, and our next After Hours edition is coming in a couple weeks. We're reviewing Kinji Fukasaku's 2000 film, Battle Royale. And I do just want to briefly read the plot description here for anyone out there who isn't familiar with this movie. In the future, the Japanese government captures a class of ninth grade students and forces them to kill each other under the Revolutionary Battle Royale Act. Who doesn't want to see that movie and then hear us talk about it,
oh,
Maddie?
Oh, man, I am quivering in anticipation. Is this animated?
No, it's not.
Oh, wow.
I don't believe it
even
is, anyway.
Even better.
This is how ignorant we are of this film. We don't even know if it's animated, but I do not believe it is. I'm looking forward to checking it out. And we do want to throw a shout-out to our listeners in Seattle, Sean, the manager of the Metro Cinema, the Landmark Art House there. We like to highlight from time to time the movies they're going to be showing, kind of their own little marathons they do, and they're starting another series here this week. They're highlighting film families with movies from each of the father, mother, and daughter of the Rosalini Bergmans and the Lee Curtises and Minnelli Garlands.
Oh, that is
how
awesome.
Clever is that?
That is a great idea.
Yeah, so here are some of the movies, Maddie. Why don't you go ahead and read here some of these here, starting with October 8th.
Rome, Open City, October 15th, Notorious, October 22nd, Blue Velvet, October 29th, A Fish Called Wanda.
Yeah, in November, they've got The Manchurian Candidate and Some Like It Hot, The Bandwagon from Minnelli, The Wizard of Oz, and then they close it out with Cabaret from Bob Fosse. So if you haven't seen a lot of those movies, go check it out as part of this series at the Metro Cinema. I know they like to mention Film Spotting before it, so if you're there, you know, go meet up with some other Film Spotting listeners and have a good time.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. The soothing sounds there of Simon and Garfunkel from The Graduate. Actually, my number one choice when we did this top five movie soundtracks list about 3 years ago on the show. We wanted to revive this list, tying in with Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist last week when we discussed it. Of course, with the passing of Paul Newman, we decided to pay tribute to him and put the soundtracks list on hold. But this should really be a fun one. I'm going to get to what my picks were last time here at the end. I don't want to potentially take any of your picks, but I'm really curious, how did you form your list? Because I do remember the last time we did this, we left out scores. We saved that for another top five. This is really kind of compilation albums. How did you do it?
Yeah, that's one rule I had. I also had no movie musicals, so no Snow White or Sound of Music, no concert films.
Okay.
That's another big one.
I agree
one.
With that one.
And basically, the film for me had to use memorable songs throughout the film, and on a personal note, I had to own the soundtrack on vinyl or CD.
Yep.
And I actually came up with 10. And I'm going to go through my 10 through 6 really, really quickly.
Okay.
I think actually a lot of lists out there will probably depend on when you came of age. And that's certainly true for my number 10, The Crow, Time to Take Her Home, of course, from and Color Me Once by my all-time favorite band, The Violent Femmes, Little Henry Rollins and Trent Reznor. Number 9, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, a little song called Knocking on Heaven's Door. Number 8, Pump Up the Volume. Everybody knows Christian Slater was the epitome of cool. Number 7, Lost Highway, always feeds my Rammstein fix. And number 6, Reservoir Dogs, who has not been in a group of guys walking down the street
and not heard
and,
the music.
And started, you know, singing Little Green Bag to themselves. But my number 5 is Rushmore. I think filmmaker Wes Anderson is brilliant at incorporating iconic, sometimes forgotten songs to heighten a mood within his films. Here in Rushmore, it's all about the girls and songs that capture the power that women have to drive us to do really silly, lovely things. Oh, Yoko from John Lennon. And of course, a little Cat Stevens, Here Comes My Baby.
Yeah, and Making Time by The Who, a great kind of overlooked tune. Rushmore was actually my number 5, got just bounced out at the last minute. That really is a great soundtrack. And for me, the big criterion is that the songs not only have to be integral to the film, you can't imagine the movie without it, but I also want to listen to the soundtrack separate from the film. Like you, Maddie, I had to own it. My number 5, 24-Hour Party People, a little Michael Winterbottom movie, of course. And, you know, the Manchester scene, the Hacienda, not really my scene. Those aren't bands I listen to a lot. But if you want to go back and get familiar with it, this is the place to start, I think, in many ways. You've got some great Joy Division tunes on there. Transmission, She's Lost Control. Of course, Love Will Tear Us Apart. New Order tunes are great. Anarchy in the UK, the first track on the soundtrack from the Sex Pistols, starting it off. Really, that's kind of your primer, I think, for that era. Got to have a little 24-Hour Party People. And Steve Coogan, of course, so memorable in that film as Tony Wilson.
Well, I will see your 70s Manchester scene, and I will raise you the 1970s reggae scene. This one, 1973, The Harder They Come. Jimmy Cliff starred in the film and put the soundtrack together, featuring the Maytals and, of course, Cliff himself on the title track. And my favorite cut on the album, Many Rivers to Cross. Let's go ahead and hear a clip.
My way over, wandering, I am lost as I travel along the white cliffs of Dover.
Well, let's go ahead and just stick with the 70s. Maddie, one I know a lot of listeners couldn't believe made my list last time. It is Richard Linklater's Dazed and Confused. And I'll admit that it kind of violates my criterion a little bit because the fact is I no longer listen to classic rock. I don't care how good it is. I don't care what band it is. I refuse to listen to classic rock. I just can't do it. But here you've got Schools Out, Love Hurts, Fox on the Run, Tuesday's Gone.
Oh, Tuesday's Gone with the Wind. I love that song.
Great anthemic collection of mid-70s tunes used to perfection there by Linklater. You know, you can really pick out the sequences in the movie defined by those songs.
That opening to Sweet Emotion as the car drives into the parking lot. Oh,
Low Rider,
choice.
Some great stuff there.
All right, well, my number three, it's pretty obvious, but it is American Graffiti. I am the proud owner of 41 original hits from American Graffiti. It is the soundtrack, really, of the 50s and the early 60s. These feel-good hits reflecting a time before rock and roll would take a huge turn, along with our country, of course, and start to trace the loss of our innocence found in those songs. And it's funny because I didn't grow up with pop music. My dad, as you know, was a jazz musician, mm-hmm. so I grew up with Dixieland jazz. My mom basically stopped listening to music around the 1960s. So I grew up listening to Bill Haley, Fats Domino, and the Platters. And so, oddly, this soundtrack, even though I'm only 25 years young, is the soundtrack to my youth in a lot of ways.
That's really interesting. It is a fantastic pick there, without a doubt. My number three, we've heard a lot of clips from this movie. We've heard the same song from this movie quite a bit over the past year. Let's go ahead and hear another song from this recent film.
So, if you want something, and you call, then I'll come running to fight.
That's When Your Mind's Made Up from the Once soundtrack, a movie that could not have been on my list the last time we did it, but now it is a soundtrack I absolutely adore. Of course, that movie is kind of a musical, though. In a way, violates your criterion there, Maddie, but Lies is a great song. That one, Trying to Pull Myself Away, Say It to Me Now, and of course, Falling Slowly, the song I think everyone remembers from that movie. It is my favorite scene in the movie where they perform it for the first time. I still have a total man crush on Glenn Hansard. What can I say? Had to be on my list.
All right, we'll talk about man crushes. Let's go to my number two. Gotta show my love to Paisley Park Studios and a little Prince Nelson. Prince, Purple Rain, 1984. This is one of those albums I can listen to the entire way through, which basically, sort of in this digital age of singles and iTunes, that's quickly going the way of the dinosaur. And you know, Adam, I never meant to cause you any sorrow.
I never meant to cause you any pain. I don't want to watch that nasty laughing.
It's a great movie, Purple Rain. Actually, I think it's a good movie. I still love it from my childhood, and it's an even better soundtrack. I'm right there with you. My number two, another fairly recent film, and that is Good Will Hunting. As Ben Folds recently said, Elliot, man, you played a fine guitar and some dirty basketball. I'm a big Elliot Smith fan, and I became a big Elliot Smith fan because of the movie Good Will Hunting. You have Danny Elfman on there as well and some others, but six tunes from the late, great Elliot Smith, including the Oscar-nominated Miss Misery. I heard that song and instantly bought everything I could find by Elliot Smith at the time. He actually performed the tune at the 1998 Oscars. I will include a link to that performance because it's on YouTube in the notes for this show at filmspotting.net.
Well, number one, I mean, people probably could see this coming from a mile away because we haven't mentioned it yet. It is from some of the greatest songwriters of the late 20th century. I give you Saturday Night Fever.
You can't tell by the way I use my walk, I'm a woman's man, no time to talk. Music loud, women walk, but they kicked around since I was born. I never tolerate, that's okay, and you may look the other way, but we can't try.
I don't think there's really much I need to say about this album. If you don't own it, I don't know why. I think it is the best soundtrack ever.
You're a disco guy.
Well, I'm a disco. Those songs are great. They really are great songs. People sort of overlook them because they quickly dismiss them as just disco songs. Well, they're really not, and they drive that movie, and they drive that story so well.
Yeah, no, it's a great pick there. My number one is, not surprisingly maybe, a Cameron Crowe film. Maybe not the one everyone's thinking of, and I'll get to that in a minute, but it's actually his recent film, Elizabethtown.
I've had some time to think about it and watch the sun sing like a song. I've had some time to think about you on the lawn.
That's a tune called Long Ride Home from Patty Griffin, a song I had never heard before I saw the movie Elizabethtown. So glad I heard it because the entire soundtrack is amazing. One of the first soundtracks recently I went out and bought in the past few years that I said, I got to go get those songs. And I went out and got it on my iPod right away. You have two great Tom Petty tunes there as well. It'll All Work Out in Square One. Those are songs that made me realize I was an idiot for not liking Tom Petty, and it made me go out and get his most recent album, Highway Companion, which I love. But again, introduced me to Patty Griffin. Ryan Adams has a great song on there called Come Pick Me Up. There are only a couple tunes on there I skip, so Elizabethtown is my number one.
Well, I didn't know we were doing top five soundtracks that were better than the movie itself.
It would certainly be number one on that list as well. I had a few honorable mentions I'll throw out there. Hedwig and the Angry Inch, though a musical. Mm-hmm. A Hard Day's Night almost doesn't count, but, you know, it's the Beatles. Nashville, the Robert Altman film. The Blues Brothers. Mm-hmm. Rushmore, number five on your list. And, of course, American Graffiti. And I do just have to mention that, you know, anyone out there listening, you know, Adam, your list is pretty good, but you left out a lot of obvious ones. Again, we did this list previously. I encourage anyone to go over to filmspotting.net and click on the top five page. You'll actually find my top 15 there. What you just heard is really just my 16 through 20, because I actually managed to sneak in 15 films on the last
top five.
We
could do a Columbia House infomercial on this alone.
Yeah.
My honorable mention, Animal House, Once You Mentioned It, Blues Brothers, Singles, Garden State, Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, Gross Point Blank, Nashville, Trainspotting, and Dazed and Confused. You already mentioned it.
And I'll save some people the click there, Maddie. Some of those that you just mentioned were in my top five from last time, including Garden State and Say Anything and Singles from Cameron Crowe.
All right. Well, those are our top five movie soundtracks. Send your top five or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
Out new in wide release this weekend, City of Ember with Bill Murray and Tim Robbins, The Express about Ernie Davis, about the first African American.
I'm really looking
forward
to that one.
A movie we're not really looking forward to, Quarantine, a horror movie that I've seen the trailers for way too many times now. And, of course, Body of Lies, which we are recommending the new Ridley Scott film. Also, The Duchess with Keira Knightley and Ralph Fiennes is expanding to more screens. Next week on the show, we're going to review Jonathan Demme's Rachel Getting Married with Anne Hathaway, and we're going to preview the Chicago International Film Festival. Some really good titles coming up. We may also have, at some point here in the next 2 weeks, Rian Johnson on the show. The Brothers Bloom is actually opening the Chicago Film Fest, so you can look forward to that. And, you know, of course, we're hoping to chime in maybe with some of the reviews of movies people here locally can catch up with at the fest. And for those of you outside of Chicago listening, maybe you can catch up with them when they are released on DVD. The top five, I think, Maddie, we did agree, maybe some kind of breakout performances. Mm-hmm. Top five topic tying in with Anne Hathaway getting a lot of raves for her performance and Rachel Getting Married. But as always, we are open to any suggestions. You know how to find us, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Thanks, as always, to Candace for her invaluable assistance and to our great listener volunteers, Frank and Angela. Special thanks to Tori Malatia and Steve Edwards at Chicago Public Radio, along with Golden Joe Dassault for his great production help, and to Connor Oberst and Merge Records for this week's music. Learn more at mergerecords.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Matty Robinson.
I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
For original coverage of this year's film festivals, check out blog.spout.com. Then discover more about the movies and join the conversation yourself at spout.com.
You look very Mr. Rogers-ish today. I like that.
Yeah.
It's a nice...
Yeah.
Congenial.
Very sort of... Yeah. Church prayer group.
Yeah. Damn, that was good. I was so not ready. What do you say to Tempe?
Is that how you say Tempe, or is it Tempe?
I think it's Tempe.
Tempe.
I think it's Tempe.
I'm going to put it up by Tempe.
Okay. Where's the magic?
Oh, God. All right. Here we go. I'm going to ramble.
Does she know she's going to be part of this?
She doesn't even know I'm a film critic.
Okay. Nice. It went that well, huh?
Just wait.